The Assassin.
You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest. You know I break necks, call me Jack Tate. I have no regrets while your life is fading. I'm a crazy fuck equivalent to Satan. When I'm behind the mic, I feel like the greatest.
What up, y'all? You're listening to Sports Talk with Trop, and I'm your host, Katie Trop. On today's episode, I've compiled some of my Trop 5 lists from last year. I'm calling this one NBA Legends. It's the Trop 5 Kobe Moments, Trop 5 Greatest NBA Coaches of All Time, and the Trop 5 Bill Russell Moments. So enjoy. But now that I've ranted about that, let's actually talk about a good player who did make the Hall of Fame. On Wednesday, it was the two-year anniversary of when Kobe Bryant died. Kobe Bryant is why I love basketball. He is my favorite basketball player of all time. Actually, Tim Duncan's my second. It's kind of like Kobe's one, Tim Duncan's 1A. I love both of them for many different reasons, and it was great to get to watch both of them at the exact same time. And it was weird, too, that they both retired in the exact same year. But Kobe Bryant is why I watch basketball. Watching Kobe Bryant play basketball, it was just so amazing to watch. And so since it had been 2 years since he passed, I kind of feel like I'm going to do the Trop 5 Kobe Moments. I do want to say the day he died, I do remember exactly where I was and what I was doing. I was filming a music video called When I Catch You with my friend Clay. Plato the World Destroyer, the director Eric Sattler, and the photographer named Jason. We were all at a studio, and Jason just happened to come from the back room, and he goes, someone was in a helicopter crash. And like, me, Clay, and Eric, we're over on the set side trying to like figure out what we're going to do this for this video, so it didn't really hit me. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a second. Who'd you say? What'd you say? So who got in a helicopter crash? And he goes, Kobe. And I like look at him and like I do like the basketball shot. I'm like, Kobe? And he's like, yeah. I'm like, and I remember sitting there because like you hear the words helicopter crash. And in my head, the five-year-old inside of me was like, is he okay? When in reality, come on, he was in a helicopter crash. Of course he's not okay. He's more than likely dead. Unfortunately, so he gave us that news, and it was like a punch in the gut. I'm like, oh, fuck. And so we start filming the video, and then probably about, we take a break after about an hour or two, and I go just to take a look at my cell phone, and of course, it's blown up, because anybody who knows me knows I'm a huge Lakers fan, but also at the same time knows I love Kobe. And I'm getting all these text messages, oh my God, did you hear Kobe died? And then I see one of the alerts on my phone, a news alert, Kobe Bryant has died. And I'm like, what? I was so blown away. And I remember after we filmed the video, I basically went home and was watching all the basketball games going on and them letting the 24-second clock run out. And it's just like, it was so surreal, like, because you're like, Jesus Christ, because he was only in his 40s, you know? This is Kobe Bryant. Like, if you're a Kobe Bryant fan, he could do anything. And I know that sounds stupid and childish, but if you're a basketball fan and you loved Kobe, that you know exactly what I mean when you say he could do anything. So when you hear he's dead, of course, he's a human. Humans die. That's what happened. That's what happens to everybody. That's when, if you're alive right now, you're going to be dead one of these days. And so of course it's going to happen to Kobe, but like you just didn't think it was going to happen to Kobe. At least that early, you know, we wanted to see him. You want to see him get inducted into the Hall of Fame. You want to see him on the sidelines at Laker games. You know, you wanted to see that. And so it was just very shocking on many levels. But with that being said, you know, like I said, he was my favorite player. He still is my favorite player to this day. And so I'm going to do my Trop 5 Kobe Moments. And it was actually really fun to actually, because I rewatched all of these moments that I'm going to discuss. And it was fun to watch just because there was nobody like Kobe before. He got into the NBA, and there's nobody still to this day who plays the game like he did. And it was fun to rewatch a lot of his moments. So I'm going to start with a few honorable mentions. This first honorable mention, it's the epitome of why I love Kobe Bryant. It was Christmas Day, 2005. This is the first year without Shaq. Like I said, I'm Kobe over everybody. So when that Kobe Shaq shit was going down, I was Kobe. I was Team Kobe. I love Shaq. I love what he brought to the team, but I'm Kobe over everybody, even then. So Christmas Day 2005, we're playing the Miami Heat. That's where Shaq was traded to. It ended up being a loss, 97-92. The reason why I put this on here as an honorable mention is, A, because they lost. I wasn't going to put a fucking loss on there in my top five. But the reason why it stuck out to me is I remember after they lost this game. One of the reasons why they lost is because the Lakers were missing a lot of shots. And Kobe specifically, he missed a few shots in the game. And after the game, ESPN is taking shots of Kobe. After the game, this dude is on the Miami Heat basketball court shooting shots. And he's shooting the shots that he missed. And that's why I put this on here, because that's the type of dude he was. If he fucked up, it wasn't because everybody else was the problem. If he fucked up, he was going to go out there and he was like, I got to fix this shit. And that's what he did. He went right out, right after that game, went to the exact spots that he missed the shots and was just shooting those hoops to make them and to teach his brain, you got to make these shots, stupid. So that was an honorable mention, and it's always stuck out to me too. I just remember watching it, and I'm like, this is why I love you, Kobe. The next honorable mention is from April 12th, 2013, playing the Golden State Warriors. It was a very close battle. This season, Kobe had played more minutes than he had ever played in his entire career. This team was on his back, and then he tore his Achilles. Now, when he first went down, you're looking like, oh shit. He just sprained his ankle. It's Kobe. He's going to be okay. But the more you look at him, you're like, fuck. And then they replayed when he hurt himself. And I've watched so many sports at this point in time that I know what it looks like when you rupture your Achilles or you tear an ACL. When it's one of those type of non-contact injuries, I always know. And I remember watching the replays. I'm like, fuck, I think he tore his Achilles. And he did. He did tear his Achilles. But on this particular play, when he tore his Achilles, he was fouled. And the reason why I put this in my top five honorable mentions is because after he tore his Achilles, he walked right up to the free throw line and made the free throws. Now, he did leave the game, of course, after that. The Lakers did end up winning 118-116. That's the common theme you're actually going to find in a lot of these top five moments is that while he was the focal point, and the funny thing is about Kobe Bryant's time when he played, nobody likes to give him credit for all the points he scores. He scores too much. He shoots up too many threes. He throws up too many points. And it's like, yeah, we get the win, stupid. And that's what you're going to see in a lot of these common themes is that even though the pressure's on him and he scores a lot of fucking points, the Lakers got a lot of fucking wins because of it. But in today's day and age, man, they want to see Steph Curry throw up 900,000 threes and ain't nobody got a problem with it. I don't have a problem with it either, but I'm just saying it's really funny to see how the times have changed with being the dude who just throws up all the baskets. But regardless, that the torn Achilles game, that's just another reason why I loved Kobe Bryant, because that was his mentality. Was like, I don't give a shit if I got a torn Achilles. I'm going to at least go shoot my free throws. And he did. Of course, the Lakers were headed into the playoffs that year because that was April. So that's I think that was a couple weeks before the playoffs began. And we ended up losing in the first round, of course, because we ain't going to win nothing without Kobe Bryant. But yeah, that was a big game. And we didn't have him for a playoff run. And that was one of my favorite Kobe Bryant moments. Then the last honorable mention I have is from the 2006 first round playoffs. This is without Shaq again. So that's all we're hearing about is Shaq. But the Lakers had a great season that year. And I specifically focused on game four. At that point, the Lakers were dominating the series, but it was a real back-and-forth game between the Phoenix Suns and the Los Angeles Lakers. And, I mean, it was back-and-forth. It was so close. And if you don't remember this battle, I mean, back in the early 2000s, Lakers versus Suns was a big fucking deal. I mean, this is when we had Rajah Bell. This was when they had Steve Nash. Like, Amari Stoudemire. This was a damn good Suns team. And this game went back and forth. But if you remember it, you would remember that in the fourth quarter, there was 7 seconds left. And the Suns had, a 2-point lead. And they're getting ready to inbound. And they're inbounding to Steve Nash, the MVP of the league, by the way. Steve Nash doesn't make stupid mistakes. But here he made kind of a stupid mistake. Now, there was some real good defense on him. And I believe out of all the people who got the ball, I believe it was Smush Parker who ended up getting the ball. Playing some great defense, getting the ball out. And the Lakers ended up stealing the ball. And Kobe Bryant ended up making the game-winning shot with 7 seconds left on the clock, and game went into overtime. Then back and forth overtime, 6 seconds left on the clock, and this is a huge Kobe Bryant moment. If you are a Kobe Bryant fan, you know exactly what moment this is. He takes this beautiful shot, makes it, sinks it, turns around to the crowd, takes his jersey and kind of like takes it off of his heart, like, yeah, bitch, I got heart. You can't fuck with Kobe Bryant. And Lakers ended up going up strong in the series, but they ended up losing. They went up 3-1 on the Phoenix Suns, but they ended up losing the entire series. But I just really liked, that's just a game four. They won 99-98, by the way. But that's just a game that's always stuck out to me. And I just remember the rivalry between the Phoenix Suns. And that was just a crazy game to watch. Now it's time for the top five moments. And as you can imagine, it was very difficult to dwindle this down to five moments. Even those honorable mentions. Like, there are so many game-winning shots that Kobe had. There are so many championships. I didn't include all of the championships on here. I only included two moments from two of the five championships he won. But it was very, very difficult to choose these five moments. But these are the five moments that stuck out most to me, and they're my top five Kobe moments. Starting with number five. And number five was his final game, April 13th, 2016, versus the Utah Jazz. And, you know, this season, Kobe's last season, the Lakers were not good. We all knew it was going to be Kobe's last season, too. You could just tell. He even announced it even prior to this game. So we all knew what was coming. Now, I basically just watched the game because it was Kobe's last game. And the way it started, it was bad. The Lakers weren't looking good at all. It's like, man, y'all can't even show up for Kobe's last game. And he wasn't struggling, but he wasn't on fire like Kobe usually is. And you're like, well, this sucks. Is Kobe's last game going to be a loss? Well, they come out in halftime. Come out after halftime. They start putting it together a little bit. I'm even starting to like doze off, because one of the things about living in Austin is it's central time here. So Laker games start pretty late for me. I go to bed kind of early. I'm an old person. So yeah, I'm usually kind of knocking out about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And if I'm watching a Lakers game or a San Francisco Giants game, It's really difficult for me to stay up late, but I did stay up for this one. I was kind of starting to doze off. I'm like, but it's Kobe's last game. Even if it's a loss, maybe he'll do something big. We'll see what happens. So, you know, the third quarter's moseying along. They're starting to kind of catch up with the Jazz, but it's not really anything. But you can kind of see Kobe turning it on. So I'm like, okay, good. Maybe Kobe's going to have a good night. Well, Kobe had an amazing night. In the final 3 minutes of the fourth quarter was when it started to get real. Kobe went off. The Lakers went off. And they actually ended up winning the game 101-96. And Kobe Bean Bryant dropped 60 motherfucking points in his last game. And that's Kobe. That's how he should go out. Of course, you want to see him go out with a championship. But that was not going to happen. I mean, his last like three seasons were just awful. Not due to him and his play, but due to the Lakers' play. They just weren't a good team at all. But in his final game, 60 points, a win. I call that a great way to see the Black Mamba go out for his career. And I still remember that game to this day. It was a very emotional game just to be like, shit, this is his last game. But it was good. And that is my number five moment. My number four, it's not just one moment, but it was a 50-point streak of four games for Kobe Bryant in the 2007 season. He just went off. That's what Kobe's known for. And like I said, people used to complain all the time. That was what everybody wanted to try. And all the haters, that's all they ever wanted to say. Hey, he scores too much. He scores too much. He just scores way too much. Okay, we still get the wins. And that's why I put this on there, because what you're going to notice is the Lakers got wins out of all of these 50-point games. So the streak first started on March 16th, 2007, against the Trailblazers. The Lakers won in overtime, 116-111. Kobe had 65 points, 7 rebounds, and 3 assists and 3 steals. At this point in time, the Lakers had lost 7 games in a row. And Kobe just knew, hey, I gotta go off. I gotta do this. So he did, and that's where he really took over, and this was it right here, and that ended that losing streak. He actually ended up scoring 24 points in the fourth quarter, and Lakers got the win. And then the next game was March 18th, 2007, against the Timberwolves. The Lakers won 109-102. Kobe ended up dropping 50 points with 6 rebounds, 3 assists, and 3 steals. He had a 17-point first quarter rather than taking over in the fourth quarter. He just was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to take over right now. And the Lakers got out to a huge lead and ended up getting the win. Then the next game, March 22nd, 2007, Lakers versus Grizzlies. Lakers won 121-119. Kobe once again, he scores 60 points. 60 points, 5 rebounds, and 4 assists. He becomes the fourth player in NBA history to score 50 or more points in 3 consecutive games, joining only Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, and Michael Jordan to ever do that. And specifically in this game, he had 17 points in the third quarter just went off, had another great game. Then the following game was March 23rd, 2007, Lakers versus Hornets. Lakers won 111-105, and Kobe's stat line was 50 points, 7 rebounds, and 1 assist. That 50-point streak came to an end the following game, but he had 43 points. So he still scored a lot. It just wasn't the 50 points. But that's what I mean. Is one of the reasons why I like that is that you notice the theme there is he scored a lot of points, and they still got the win. So I don't know what people were complaining about, but that's the only way you could ever say anything bad about Kobe at that point in time. Then my number three moment is in the 2000 finals. Game 4, actually. This is the first of 5 championships for Kobe Bryant, and this is what I'd like to call his like coming out party for the playoffs. Now, he is in that same year. They did have a great run against the Portland Trail Blazers in a game 7. He came back. It was a great game. And so that was technically his coming out party, but in the finals, most specifically game four, it was all Kobe. Up to this point, you know, they were playing the Indiana Pacers. At this time, the Pacers were an amazing team. And they just had some great players on the team. And they were great. You could not fuck with the Pacers at this time. You know, they had Reggie Miller. If you don't know who Reggie Miller is, he was the Steph Curry before Steph Curry would hit the court. They also had Jalen Rose at the time. They were a really good team. And so the Lakers had their hands full, especially going into game four. Kobe was actually injured in game two. Jalen Rose slid under him when he was shooting up a mid-range jumper. And it looked like it was on purpose, and Jalen Rose has admitted to this day it was on purpose, but whatever. The Lakers won the series in six games, so ha-ha. But basically, Kobe missed game three, and he came back for game four. And he just had some amazing plays in game four. But what was also amazing was they ended up going into overtime, and Shaq actually fouled out. Now, at this time, in this Lakers dynasty, Shaq was the focal point. If Shaq wasn't having a good game, usually that meant the Lakers weren't going to have a good game. But Shaq ended up fouling out in this game with 2:29 left in the overtime period, and Kobe just took over. He ended up there were a couple plays that most notably that I wrote down. He had this crossover pull-up jumper on Reggie Miller. He had a rise-up shot from about the same spot that Mark Jackson was like, what's going on here? He blocked Austin Crozier on a layup that would have cut the lead. And then he had the reverse tip-in at the end. And then he, with 5.9 seconds left, and the Lakers ended up winning that game, taking a 3-1 series lead. And they ended up winning, and that was their first championship. So that's my my third favorite Kobe moment. Number two, it's not just a moment. It's about the same as same thing as number four with the 50-point streak, except this one is actually more impressive. This is in January of 2006. Kobe went on a historic 13-game run where he scored a total of 564 points. This also includes the 81-point game. And that is basically what the moment, that game specifically is like the key moment. But really, 13 games, 564 points, that says a lot. And also at the time, prior to this run, Kobe was suspended. I can't remember why. He had a like hard foul or something on somebody and ended up getting suspended for a game. And Phil Jackson basically told him, show them what the fuck they just did, who they just pissed off by suspending you. And basically that's what Kobe did that month of January. And I mean that month of January, he went off January 6th against the 76ers. By the way, they won the majority of these games that I'm going to tell you about. So for the month of January, started off with Philadelphia 76ers. He scored 48 points. Next game against the Clippers, 50 points. Next game against the Pacers, 45. Next game, Portland, 41. Next game, Cleveland, 27. Next game, Golden State, 38. Miami, 37. Sacramento, 51. Phoenix, 37. Then the big game, Toronto, 81. Golden State, 30. Detroit, 39, and then rounding out the month of January against the Knicks with 40 points. That's a huge run. And during that run, the Lakers went 9-4. Now, prior to that, they weren't doing so well. They needed Kobe Bryant to score a whole bunch of points. And what did Kobe do? He scored the points, they got the wins, and went 9-4. Now, let's talk about the 81-point game. Now, the 81-point game, it sticks out in my brain like no other. One of the reasons why it sticks out in my brain is because, so at the time, I grew up in Reno, Nevada, so you would get Lakers games sometimes. You would always get the main games that would be on, but if they were playing the Raptors, that's who they were playing, and at the time, the Raptors weren't a very good team. They were okay, but they weren't like a playoff contender. So that game was not on TV, at least where I was. But I did, I remember, I was just kind of like dicking around on my computer, and I had ESPN News on, and I was watching the ticker, and I could see, like, Kobe was just going off. Every time the ticker would come back to the Lakers-Raptors game, I'd see Kobe's points going up and up. And so about halftime, I was like, shit, I should turn on, because I had Sirius satellite radio. And if you don't know, they play every single game. I'm like, well, I should at least listen to what's going on. So I turn on the game. And, you know, listening to games is not the same as watching games. But I'm not going to lie, I felt like I was watching this game. As it just keeps going on, I'm like, holy shit, he's doing it. He's doing it. And he ended up with 81 points. That's the second most points anybody's ever scored. Wilt Chamberlain scored 100. And they don't even have, like, a footage of him on the court. That's how long ago it was. So to see somebody score 81 points, I mean, of course it's going to be Kobe. That's just who Kobe was. But that was just, I listened to it on the radio and I felt like I watched it. And I still remember to this day listening to that on the radio and being like, holy shit, it's too bad this game was not on TV on a nationally televised level, because that was one of the most insane things. And that was Kobe, man. If you know, if you are a Kobe fan, that 81-point game is right up there. My number one Kobe moment is actually not just a Kobe moment. It's actually my favorite Lakers championship they've ever won in my lifetime, at least. I've watched them win six of them, and my favorite one was the 2010 NBA Finals. And so that's my number one favorite Kobe moment. And it's funny too, because in game, it went seven games, and this was a battle. This was a great Celtics team. You know, they had Paul Pierce, they had Kevin Garnett, they had Ray Allen. This team was stacked, and it was a battle the whole way through. I remember just watching every game, being on the edge of my seat, like, is this series ever coming to an end? Are the Lakers going to beat the Celtics? Because if you don't remember, 2 years prior to this one, they lost to the Celtics in the NBA Finals in terrible fashion, too. Like, it wasn't even close. So this time, the Lakers played great defense. They were playing great. And Game 7 was in L.A. And I kid you not, Kobe Bryant probably had the worst game of his career in Game 7. He went 6 for 24. He couldn't drop a pass or a drop a bucket that night. He was playing so horrible, but he made the shots that he needed to make. Who really stepped it up in this game was Lamar Odom stepped it up. Pau Gasol stepped it up. I believe Andrew Bynum had a good game too. So everybody else around him stepped it up. But I mean, overall in the series, Kobe had a great series. But this was, it was one of the most, it's the most enjoyable NBA Finals to me, especially because, you know, the Kobe-Shaq thing, it really, really accentuated the hate on Kobe. I mean, being a Kobe fan, I've been in so many, like, very heated arguments over Kobe. He's a very polarizing player for whatever reason. And not even because of the rape accusations. That even before that happened, people like really hated Kobe. And so that year when he won the 2010 NBA Finals was like a real, it was really vindicating, because lots of people had Shaq's back for whatever reason. And that's fine if you did, if you liked him, whatever. But Kobe needed to prove something. And he did. He won two titles without Shaq. But this one, I think, was the sweetest of all. Because, you know, the year before, they beat the Orlando Magic, who weren't that good. But this Celtics team was legit. This was a legit series. I think it was the hardest series that he ever played in. And to me, it still sticks out in my head. It's my favorite NBA Finals I've ever watched, especially for the Lakers. And that's my number one Kobe moment. So that's my top five Kobe moments. I'm really appreciative that I got to see his entire career. He can't hear me, but I really thank him for all the great memories he's provided me. Like I said, getting to rewatch a lot of these moments, it was awesome. And there's nobody like him, and I don't think there's ever going to be anybody like him. And so with that, I'm going to end it today's show with a Kobe Bryant quote. It's my favorite Kobe Bryant quote. It sits right next to me. I see it every single day. It really relates to me in life because I totally feel this quote. I can't relate to lazy people. We do not speak the same language. I don't understand you. I don't want to understand you. The great Kobe Bean Bryant. Right. This week, Greg Popovich, the great coach of the San Antonio Spurs, actually tied Don Nelson as the coach with the most wins. So he's gonna definitely break that record at some point this season. The Spurs are a trash-ass team. That's why it's like, what the fuck are the Lakers doing losing to the Spurs and the Rockets, two of the worst teams in the league? But cool. Way to go, guys. Suck ass. But Greg Popovich, he ended up tying Don Nelson, and so they're both tied with the most wins as a coach. By the way, that tie was against the Lakers, by the way. Can you believe that? The Lakers, that's just so fucking weird. Who would have thought? Oh, I would have thought. Yeah, I would have thought. I actually knew that was going to happen when I heard that Popovich was only a game away from tying. I was like, oh, cool. I see the Lakers are next up on their schedule. I'm sure that's where he's going to tie it up, right there against the Lakers. That's the perfect fucking opportunity. But anyways, that got me thinking about one of the great sports fans debates are who are the greatest NBA coaches of all time. And obviously, Greg Popovich is definitely one of them. And so I decided to put together my top five greatest NBA coaches of all time. And when you actually do the research on it, it's actually a very easy list, in my opinion. I already knew who my top three were right off the bat when I thought about it. And then I was like, who are going to be four and five? And then when I really thought about it, I was like, oh, yeah, four and five. I thought of them in my head. And then when I started doing research, I was like, oh, yeah, this is not even close. At least as far as the top five goes, 100%. I don't think you can argue really with any of these unless you're a hater and you have some stupid, idiotic excuses. And believe me, I will get to some of those excuses, especially on one of my coaches, because it's always a hilarious debate. But let's go ahead and I'm going to name my top five greatest NBA coaches of all time, starting with number five, Steve Kerr. He's currently the coach of the Golden State Warriors. He's been the coach since 2014. And basically, the Warriors have done nothing but win since he's taken over the team. He took over for Mark Jackson, who completely flopped. The Warriors weren't a horrible team under Mark Jackson, but you could just tell there was something about him that the players, I don't know, couldn't connect with, or maybe the front office couldn't connect with. But basically, they fired him and hired Steve Kerr. Now, Steve Kerr, he happened to play for two of my top three coaches on my list. Greg Popovich, he played for the Spurs to end his career, but he spent the majority of his career with the Chicago Bulls under Phil Jackson. And basically, he's taken both of their coaching styles and combined them into his own. And I mean, that just goes to show that's why he's such a good coach, because he learned from Greg Popovich and Phil Jackson, two of the greatest coaches of all time. That's really awesome to see somebody take that knowledge and turn it into this and then become one of the greats as well. That's why I knew at first I was like, should I put Steve Kerr on here? Because he hasn't been in the league that long, especially compared to the top four. But he's done so much, especially compared to everybody below him, where I'm like, you actually do have to put him in the top five, at least for now, until somebody happens to surpass him. But it's going to be very difficult. Steve Kerr is a three-time champion. He won with the Warriors in 2015, 2017, and 2018. In that time period, they actually went to five straight NBA finals, and so they lost two of them. They lost the one to the Cavaliers in Game 7, and then they lost to the Raptors in 2019. His overall record at this point is he's 420 wins, 193 losses, for a 685 winning percentage at this point. He led the Golden State Warriors to an NBA record 73-9 regular season. That was the 2015-2016 season, although that was the season they did lose to the Cavaliers. So, I mean, that kind of puts a damper on that NBA record. But still, that team absolutely dominated in the regular season. And you really can't say anything bad about Steve Kerr. He's you could tell he connects with the players very well. And he just knows how to win. And I mean, really, I when I was sitting here thinking about it, I'm like, do I really want to put Steve Kerr? Yeah, you got to put Steve Kerr in there. He has even more accolades than what I'm naming off. But I mean, the lists are so long. It's like I only have so much time, obviously. But then some of his notable players that have played for him: Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson, and Draymond Green. All exceptional players, and I think Steph Curry and Kevin Durant are shoo-ins for the Hall of Fame. Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, I we'll see where history lies with that. But I mean, Steph Curry came in and changed the game, and Kevin Durant's been one of the best players since he hit the league. So those are just some of the notable players who have played under Steve Kerr. Then number four on my top five greatest NBA coaches of all time, Pat Riley. He coached the Los Angeles Lakers from 1981 to 1990, the New York Knicks from 1991 to 1995, and then the Miami Heat from 1995 to 2003, and then 2005 to 2008. He is one of the winningest coaches ever of all time. He's a five-time NBA champion. He's been to nine total NBA finals. He won in 1982, 1985, 1987, 1988 with the Lakers, and then in 2006 with the Miami Heat. He was the coach of Showtime Lakers. So, I mean, they were the league at the time, them and the Celtics. It was all about them. The three he lost three with the Lakers, and then he lost one with the Knicks. He got all three of the franchises to the finals. So that's just crazy. I mean, he was successful at every level, and as an NBA executive, which he currently is, he is one of the top executives. He's made great moves throughout his career, and he's a three-time champion as an NBA executive. Overall, his overall record is 1,210 wins, 694 losses for a 636 winning percentage. He's most known for defense. Now, like I said, he coached the Showtime Lakers, who everybody remembers them offensively, but defensively is really where they made their bread and butter. That was what made them such a special team, is their defense. And I know a lot of people don't remember that, but that's what they were known for. And so that's kind of just what he was all about, was defense, defense, defense. And that's what won them their championships. Some of the notable players who played for him were Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, James Worthy, Patrick Ewing, Dwayne Wade, and Shaquille O'Neal, all Hall of Famers, all amazing players. And quite frankly, I could have gone on even more, but those were just the highlights that I had for who Pat Riley has coached throughout his amazing career. Then number three on my top five greatest NBA coaches of all time, Greg Popovich. He's been with the San Antonio Spurs his entire career from 1996 till today. He's a five-time NBA champion with six total. He's been to six total. They won 1999, 2003, 2005, 2007, and 2014. They lost in 2013 to the Miami Heat. His records, I mean, since he's still in the league, his record currently is 1,335 wins, 694 losses for a 658 winning percentage. And he's just known as being just a solid, great coach. What I've always loved about Greg Popovich is he's no bullshit. And I've always loved Greg Popovich. I mean, as a Lakers fan, you're supposed to hate the Spurs. I've always respected the Spurs. I've always been I've mentioned it before in the past. Tim Duncan is one of my favorite basketball players all time. Hands down, love Tim Duncan. I also love Tony Parker, Monty Ginobili, David Robinson. But I just have always respected Greg Popovich for his style of coaching. He just sticks to what he knows. He knows how to find like nobody would really know who Tony Parker or Monty Ginobili were, I think, if it weren't for Greg Popovich. He knew their skill set, and he was able to make it flourish into two Hall of Fame players, hands down. And notable players under Greg Popovich are basically just named off, the majority of them: David Robinson, Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Monty Ginobili are just some highlights. But there were many that, and still many to this day, that Popovich has coached. Popovich probably, it's really difficult to tell how much longer he has in the NBA. Ever since Tim Duncan retired, the Spurs have actually been a pretty shitty team. They haven't even made the playoffs in the last couple of years. So I wouldn't be shocked to see him retire in the next, I'd say, 1 to 3 years. But, I mean, he's had a stellar coaching career, and I've personally enjoyed it, and I don't think the Spurs are going to make the playoffs this year either, so I wouldn't be shocked to actually see him retire this year, but we'll see where it goes with Pop. Then number two on my top five greatest NBA coaches of all time, Red Auerbach, the Boston Celtics coach from 1950 to 1966. He is a 9-time NBA champion. The Boston Celtics actually went to 10 NBA championships in a row when he was the coach. They won in 1957, and then they won from 1959 all the way through 1966. So yeah, they won 8 in a row for 9 total. Just one of the greatest. That was basically the first dynasty ever. His overall record was 938 wins, 479 losses with a 662 winning percentage. And he was just a really innovative coach. First of all, he actually drafted the first black player ever, a guy named Chuck Cooper. And he never cared what you looked like. And so he was just that guy who basically made the push for black men to make it in the NBA. So that was definitely what he was all about. Another very impressive thing that I find most impressive, and it was actually kind of difficult for me to not put him at number one for this, but I didn't put him at number one, and obviously I'll go into more depth because if you haven't figured it out, it should be pretty easy to figure out who my number one is. But it almost put R back at number one, but I had to put number one at number one because I'll tell you why in a bit. But Red Auerbach coached with no bench coaches because at the time, you know, NBA didn't really get that popular until the Showtime Lakers, basically. Before then, I mean, the NBA was a dwindling league. And, you know, a lot of teams were close to folding. And there really wasn't a huge future in NBA. So now when you're watching an NBA game, you see that there's a bench with full of coaches. There's usually, like, you know, 5 to 10 coaches, bench coaches. And in Red Auerbach's day, it was just the coach, the one coach. So it's very impressive that not only was he, because he was a huge innovator when it just came to the way basketball is played and the way it is still to this day. There's just, his DNA is all over the NBA. And the fact that he coached with no bench coaches is just insanely, it's just very impressive. And you just couldn't imagine it, especially in today's NBA. I mean, hell, even just as early as the 90s. I mean, remember when the O.J. Simpson driving in the Bronco on the highway and, you know, you got the helicopter over him and breaking news. That was during an NBA Finals game. Actually, an NBA Finals game that Pat Riley was coaching in, as a matter of fact. Yeah, he did coach in that one because, yeah, it was the Knicks. So at that time, I mean, NBA games weren't even shown live. I mean, you would have to watch it after the news, the live news, and then they would show the game that was already played. And so, like I said, at that time, they broke in on the NBA Finals to see O.J. Simpson driving down the highway about to be arrested. So that's just kind of how crazy, how far the NBA has come. But back in Red Auerbach's day, it was even less. And so it's very impressive that he had no bench coaches and achieved what he achieved. And just a few notable players, because if you don't know, 13 players he coached are in the Hall of Fame. So, I mean, it was difficult to really just dwindle it down to a few. But, of course, Bill Russell, one of the greatest legendary players of all time. Ed McCauley, Bill Sharman, one of his biggest draft picks was Bill Sharman. He went to bat for that dude. Not a lot of people believed in that pick at the time, but he did, and it worked out perfect. And then Casey Jones. So Red Auerbach, number two. And so my number one top five greatest NBA coach of all time is Phil Jackson. He coached the Chicago Bulls from 1989 to 1998. Coached the Los Angeles Lakers from 1999 to 2004, and then from 2005 to 2011. He's an 11-time NBA champion. He's been to 13 total. And he's the king of the three-peat when it comes to NBA championships. With the Bulls, they won for in 91, 92, and 93, and then 96, 97, 98. Then with the Lakers, he won in 2000, 2001, and 2002, then in 2009 and in 2010. And actually with those last two there, they actually lost to the Boston Celtics in 2008. That makes me want to vomit, even just saying that. And then the other loss was to the Detroit Pistons. And that was at 03, 04? Yeah, so those are the two that he's lost. His overall record is 1,155 wins, 485 losses for a 704 winning percentage. If you'll notice, that's higher, significantly higher than all the other four guys on this list that I've mentioned. He's also had a winning record every single year of his career. No other coach can say that. And some of the notable players he coached, Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Steve Kerr, Dennis Rodman, Kobe Bryant, Shaquille O'Neal, Pau Gasol, and the underrated Derek Fisher. And there's even more you can name off. And a lot of people don't want to put Phil Jackson as number one because they like to make the most idiotic loser argument of all time. And that is, he coached Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant and shit. And they like to name off all these great players that he coached. And it's like, yeah. Well, in this top five list, I don't know if you noticed, but I named off a whole bunch of Hall of Famers that these other guys have coached. That's called a winning career. You have to have great players to actually win motherfucking games, stupid. And to actually keep all of these big ass egos in check all at the same fucking time is actually pretty goddamn difficult. And look at it. I mean, Steve Kerr played for him and is now one of the top coaches of all time. Not even just on my list. I actually, like I said, I did a lot of research on this. Steve Kerr is on a lot of people's lists. So I'm just saying, you people who like to hate on Phil Jackson because that's the cool thing to do, if you actually look at the statistics and compare him side by side, really, the only thing I could put over him with Red Auerbach was that he had no bench coaches. But other than that, Phil Jackson literally blows all of these dudes out of the water. And I just think it's because people really don't like him that they have to. It's just loser talk. That's how losers justify being a loser is, oh man, I gotta be upset and I gotta create lies. And it's like, dude, Michael Jordan wasn't shit until Phil Jackson came around and turned that team around. Also, Michael Jordan didn't do it all by himself. I just named off a couple people. Could you imagine coaching Dennis Rodman? Dennis Rodman actually didn't work too well with Greg Popovich, as a matter of fact. So yeah. Then can you imagine dealing with Kobe and Shaq? We all know how that shit went down. Come on. He wrote a whole fucking book about it. So, but, you know, Phil Jackson was basically the inventor of the triangle offense, something that Steve Kerr uses in his offense, just saying. And it's actually one of the most difficult offenses to master. You have to have the perfect players to master the triangle offense. And he was the master at the triangle offense. And he just had a spectacular coaching career. He actually had a good basketball career too as a player. But he just knows basketball inside and out. And, really, if you want to argue with me that Red Auerbach's better than him, I can go with that argument. But everybody else on this list, you actually can't argue with me on. But you know, like I said, the argument that, oh my God, he coached a bunch of good players. Well, like I said, with, Red Auerbach, that means you got to take him off the list because, 13 of his players are in the Hall of Fame. Those are great players. So we got to take him off the list then because he just had nothing but great players around him. Right. And then you got Greg Popovich who hasn't done shit since Tim Duncan left. So you got to get rid of him because, I mean, oh my God, he hasn't done anything without any good players. And I mean, there's actual proof of that right now too. I don't think it counts against him, but I'm just using all your idiotic arguments against you. And then what about Pat Riley here? He had Showtime, you know, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Patrick Ewing. Those are some of the greatest players of all time. So that means you got to take him out of there. And then Steve Kerr, his career is too early for him to really have any Hall of Famers. But like I said, Steph Curry and Kevin Durant, those sound like two shoe-ins to me. So you got to get rid of him too. So basically that leaves your list at nobody because only successful coaches have successful players. So, you know, that's my top five list, NBA greatest coaches of all time. Like I said, I thought it was pretty fucking easy. Today's show, we're going to end with a top five. Unfortunately, yesterday, the great legendary Bill Russell passed away at the age of 88, the legendary Boston Celtics player. probably the first ever NBA superstar of all time, one of the most decorated NBA superstars of all time, and hands down one of the greatest basketball players of all time, also a great human as well. He died yesterday. He was an 11-time NBA champion. He's a 5-time MVP, 12-time All-Star, 4-time rebound champion. His career statistics are points, 14,522. He averaged 15.1 points per game. Then career rebounds, 21,620. He averaged 22.5 rebounds per game for his career. And then career assists, he had 4,100. And he averaged 4.3 assists per game. So obviously, and there's even more. Like, honestly, you can't even really name off his resume because it's so long. It was actually really difficult to try and find five moments, because at first what I was going to do is I was going to rank all of his championships. But that was difficult to do because, for one, obviously he played in the early 50s and the 60s, and I was not born then, so I did not actually even get to watch those finals. Hell, there's not even a lot of footage of Bill Russell's career because this was even before anybody really filmed anything. And, you know, NBA wasn't really as big as it was today. So there's even so much footage of Bill Russell that we haven't even seen. So we don't even really know what his greatness is because we're missing so much of it. But obviously, he was one of the greatest basketball players of all time, hands down. And so I did come up with five. It was really, really difficult to do. But basically, what I did is I chose, like, one of his MVP seasons. I chose what I feel is probably the best championship season he had, and then just a couple of other highlights throughout a season, because really, if you have never looked up Bill Russell, I mean, obviously, if you've been listening to the show, I've sung my praises about Bill Russell many times. That's really why I didn't have to rattle off on his stats, because I've rattled off on a bunch of his stats many times on the show, and I haven't been doing this show, I've only been doing the show since January, so to discuss Bill Russell and his greatness multiple times and only been doing this show half a year it says a lot about what a player he is. And so obviously I've already discussed a lot of his stats and a lot of the things he's accomplished. But, I felt like I had to at least do a top five on him because he was legendary. So let's go ahead and start it off with the number five, top five Bill Russell moment. Would be in 1957-1958 season. That was his second season in the league. His first season, unfortunately, was cut short due to an injury. Not just an injury, but also he started the season late because he was playing in the Olympics as well. So he didn't start the season until, I think, like December. But anyways, in his second season, the Celtics started the season off with 14 straight wins. In one game, he actually set an NBA record for the most rebounds in one half, which was 32 rebounds in the first half, and he actually ended up with 49 rebounds overall. And in that season, he would end up averaging 22.7 rebounds per game. The Celtics would end up with a league-leading record of 49-23. He would end up winning the MVP that year. And that was his first MVP because, like I said, that was the second season of his career, and he already won the MVP, so that says a lot. But unfortunately, in the finals, they would end up facing the St. Louis Hawks, who would end up winning the finals, but that's because Bill Russell would end up getting injured in Game 3 of the finals. And once he was injured, you know, it was 1-1 going into Game 3, and then he got injured. The Hawks took that game. And I think they ended up winning in six games. So, but obviously the Celtics' play took a huge toll after Bill Russell was injured. And that is one of the only losses Bill Russell ever suffered as in the NBA Finals. He played in 13 seasons and won 11 NBA Finals. So that just right there tells you what an amazing basketball player he was. He was on some great Boston Celtics teams, but don't get it twisted. It all revolved around Bill Russell. He was the dude. So moving on to number four, top five Bill Russell moments, is 1966-1967 season was when he first took over as the coach of the Boston Celtics. So not only did he play for this team, because Red Auerbach, he retired, and I can't recall, there were two other players, or two other ex-players or ex-coaches that he wanted them to take over as coach, and they didn't want the job, and so it just ended up going to Bill Russell. And so not only was he a player, but he was a coach at the same time. So he was the first player coach, but he was the first black coach ever as well. So that was a big monumental thing for the NBA, because not only was he a player coach, but he was the first black coach. So I thought that was a huge deal, and that definitely needed to make this list. But he was a player coach for three seasons, and in those three seasons, the first season, they would end up not making the NBA Finals. I think they would lose to the 76ers in the Eastern Conference Finals. But then the 2 years after that, they would go on to go to the NBA Finals and beat my Los Angeles Lakers. So those are huge accomplishments by Bill Russell to win his last two championships as a player and a coach at the exact same time. Then at number three on my top five Bill Russell moments, I have the 1959 championship versus my Lakers. I believe they were in Minnesota at the time, though. They were not in L.A. yet. But they got swept. And the reason why I put this championship on here is because this was the first championship that began the 8 championship run that the Celtics would go on, where they would win 8 straight championships. And in this NBA Finals, Bill Russell would set the finals record of averaging 29.5 rebounds per game. And they, like I said, they would go on to win and sweep. And I really just put this on here because this was the first and the beginning of really of the greatness that was Bill Russell. Then number two on my top five Bill Russell moments, I'm just calling it the rebounding king. He was the rebounding king. He was really known for his rebounds and his defense. As you know, today's league is very offense heavy. It's actually been offense heavy for quite some time. It even, when I read about when Bill Russell came up in the league, you could tell that they even would try to say that he's going to become obsolete because the offensive game is just growing. But it didn't matter. His career was great all 13 years. But he was the rebounding king, and he had many instances where he was the rebounding king. I mean, I just told you that he did set the NBA record for 32 rebounds in the first half. So that was an NBA record for the most rebounds in a half in the NBA, and that still rings true today. Also, probably the most stellar performance he had rebound-wise was on February 3rd, 1960, versus Syracuse Nationals, not a team anymore. He had 51 rebounds, which at the time was a record, but then Wilt Chamberlain would eventually come in. I think it would be 10, 11 years later when Wilt Chamberlain would ultimately break that record, and he would end up with 55 rebounds in one game. But the stat line for this game for him was he had 51 rebounds, 23 points, and 5 assists. So that was a huge game for him. Then also in the 1960 Finals, Game 2, he had 40 rebounds, which is a Finals record. And then, like I said, he had the 32 rebounds in the first half of the finals in 1958. He was also a 4-time NBA rebound champion in 1958, 1959, 1964, 1965. And then he averaged 20 rebounds per game for 10 of his 13 seasons that he played in the NBA. So, and then, like I'd stated before, his career playoff. Or I mean, his career rebounding is is 21,620. And then his career playoff rebounds, which is a record, which is the most, is 4,104. So he was the rebounding king. He was also amazing on defense, but he was definitely known for rebounds. Then at number one on my top five Bill Russell moments, it is the 1963 season. He would win his fourth MVP. He actually considers the team after this, the following season, to be the greatest of all time. But in my personal opinion, I think this one is, just for what they had to go through to get to the NBA Finals. But in this 1963 season, he got his first triple-double ever against the New York Knicks. And his stat line for that triple-double was 17 points, 19 rebounds, and 10 assists. And he would end up winning his sixth straight finals in 1963, in which they would beat my Los Angeles Lakers in six games. In which his shining moment was in game three, where he had 21 points, 38 rebounds, and six assists. So I think that 1963 championship and that season was probably his best, even though it's really difficult to decide what is his best, because out of all of his 13 seasons, he was great. Like I said, his rookie season was really the only one that was cut short. And then his second season, they would go to the NBA Finals and they would lose because of his injury in the postseason. But I mean, overall, he was so dominating. It was basically a battle between him and Wilt Chamberlain on who had the most rebounds. And you know, Wilt Chamberlain, he scored a lot of points, so he was kind of the flashy player, but I mean, Bill Russell was always all reliable. And you really got to give it up to Bill Russell, because he really did, even though, you know, a lot of people give him his praise right now, and a lot of people talk about his greatness now. While he was playing with Boston, he did not feel the love. And even when his time ended with Boston, he did not feel the love. He just got his statue like, what, in 2013, 2011, something like that, and within the last like 15 years, which to me is egregious, just because he literally is not only one of the greatest basketball players of all time, but he's definitely one of the most legendary Boston Celtics of all time. And so it's very shocking when you actually read into the past of what it was like for him coming up, because it wasn't the way it is now. Yes, if you are a player in today's game, you do have haters, but they're usually haters from the opposing team. Usually you at least get love from the fans of your own team. But that wasn't really so much the case when he played with the Celtics. And he was pretty much a pariah with the Celtics organization for quite some time, and it was not deserved at all. So I'm happy that towards the end of his life, especially in the last 15, 20-ish years, he's definitely received his accolades, but he did not get those accolades while he was playing. And I actually found this quote from his daughter, because I have mentioned before on a past episode about a horrific experience that he had with some Celtics fans. And I actually found this quote from his daughter that kind of describes the experience even more in depth. So here it is, from Bill Russell's daughter. One night we came home from a three-day weekend and found we had been robbed. Our house was in a shambles, and the N-word was spray painted on the walls. The burglars had poured beer on the pool table and ripped up the felt. They had broken into my father's trophy case and smashed most of the trophies. I was petrified and shocked at the mess. Everyone was very upset. The police came, and after a while, they left. It was then that my parents pulled back their covers, bed covers, to discover that the burglars had defected in their bed. I mean, defecated. Yes, they shit in their bed. Every time the Celtics went out on the road, vandals would come and tip over our garbage cans. My father went to the police station to complain. The police told him that raccoons were responsible, so he asked where he could apply for a gun permit. The raccoons never came back. The only time we were really scared was after my father wrote an article about racism in professional basketball for the Saturday Evening Post. He earned the nickname Felton X. We received threatening letters, and my parents notified the FBI. What I find most telling about this episode is that years later, after Congress had passed the Freedom of Information Act, my father requested his FBI file and found that he was repeatedly referred to therein as an arrogant Negro who won't sign autographs for white children. And that is actually very true of what you read. Like, I have read that he was very reclusive and wouldn't really talk to a lot of people. And honestly, at the time, I can't blame the guy because that's the way he was treated. So you really not only got to give it up to Bill Russell for being an amazing basketball player, but for being an amazing basketball player while putting up with all that bullshit and literal bullshit in his fucking bed. So, like I said, great basketball player, even better human being for putting up with that shit. And Bill Russell has passed away at the age of 88, but I'm glad he was able to receive his accolades over the last, at least during most of my lifetime, people have discussed Bill Russell in a positive light. So when I read all that stuff, it was very telling to me because I'm like, wow, that's how you treat your superstars. That's crazy. So, you know, you really got to give it up to him for what he put up with. And he still played great and was a great basketball player for a team and for fans that did not appreciate him. So RIP to Bill Russell. Enjoy the week of sports, guys, and I will talk to you all on Friday.